Bienvenue sur Radio Créum. Welcome to Radio Créum. This is a special recording of the Breaking the Silence Conference on the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada that took place at the University of Montreal on September 26th and 27th in 2008. You will now hear part 10 of the recording, which features Paulette Regan as rapporteur of panel 4, followed by questions and comments of the public.
The way we are going to structure is we are going to first hear from the rapporteur, Paulette Regan, for about 10 minutes. Then we'll have questions and answers. And scheduled sort of for about half an hour. We'll be very careful not to cut off people. So if it goes longer, it goes longer. If it goes shorter, it goes shorter. We'll just sort of see what happens. And then to finish the day, we'll have Commissioner Claudette Dumont-Smith speak. So let's start with Paulette Regan. Paulette Regan is a senior program advisor, academic liaison at the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission. She holds a PhD from the University of Victoria on Indigenous governance. Her most recent publication is An Apology Feast in Hazelton, Indian Residential Schools, Reconciliation and Making Space for Indigenous Legal Traditions. In Indigenous Legal Traditions, Law Commission of Canada, by the UBC Press in 2007. And Paulette Regan, it's all yours now. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, everyone. Can everyone hear me? Yeah, okay. I want to first of all start by acknowledging that I'm on the traditional territories of the Mohawk peoples, and will do my best to be a respectful visitor while I'm here. So each of the presenters has raised critical issues concerning memory, ethics, and reconciliation as it relates to the work of the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They challenge us to think deeply about the process of truth-telling and reconciliation, particularly with the regard to the giving and receiving of public testimonies in public forums. What struck me in listening to these presentations are the common themes that connect them. Sue Campbell asks us, especially non-Indigenous Canadians, to reconsider our views on memory, to think about the question of who can share memory. And she notes the gap in the Canadian consciousness between the apology and the living out of the memories that will occur in the TRC. Roger Simon shares with us his worry about the pedagogical assumption that the process of public sharing of survivors' traumatic stories will not only teach Canadians about the history and legacy of Indian residential schools, but in doing so, foster a more ethical engagement with the past and an active commitment to become allies in the collective struggle for justice. Yet he reminds us that the powerful emotions that such stories evoke can have just the opposite effect. That is, the listener may respond to the stories with disbelief, denial, or guilt that precludes the kind of transformative experience envisioned in the Commission's mandate. Robina Thomas explains to us that the complexity of ethical storytelling as a methodology and as a process of relationship building. The exchange that occurs between the teller and the listener must be rooted in respect for the storyteller's truth. She cautions that many survivors, their families, and communities fear that their stories of victimization will be misunderstood and questioned, especially when heard out of context. She wonders if their stories of resistance and resilience will also be heard by Canadians. She tells us that the Commission cannot achieve its goals if non-Indigenous Canadians do not reciprocate by sharing our own stories. Roger is concerned that as the work of the Commission progresses, there is a danger that all the stories will begin to sound the same to Canadians who are listening. His too bad, so sad syndrome is the potential response of a Canadian public that is either unsympathetic or views survivors with empathy but in one-dimensional terms, that is, they see them only as victims. All of the presenters emphasize that the Commission must take seriously its ethical responsibilities as it undertakes its work. This entails designing a public dialogue process and public education program that supports an ethical response on the part of all Canadians to the history and legacy of the residential schools. Those who participate in the Commission's activities must also take responsibility. That is, taking responsibility can move non-Indigenous people away from focusing on blame and guilt towards thinking about what concrete actions they can take in the present and the future to address ongoing structures of injustice that require reforming and dismantling. So Roger says that taking responsibility will require non-Aboriginal people to do the deep learning required to understand our own role and complicity in the history and legacy of the schools. He calls for a form of public history that would support a reflexive ethical response on the part of the listener. Sue calls for this deep learning to involve the very way we think about memory, so a rethinking of our very concept of memory and how we understand that. And Rabina points out, for example, that in Indigenous contexts, storytelling is purposeful. It is both healing and liberating for the storyteller. The listener is responsible for bearing witness to and honoring the story as it unfolds. The Commission will be responsible not only to survivors and to their communities, but to listeners as well. In a very real sense, then, we must relearn our collective past, making decolonizing space for Indigenous ways of remembering history through story, ceremony, and symbol. In this way, intergenerational ethical and spiritual values are transmitted through embodied memory practices. So in listening to the presenters, I'm inspired to think about what I've heard here today and yesterday as well, in relation to my own work, which has focused on the decolonizing pedagogical potential of truth-telling and reconciliation practices. So I've been concerned particularly with exploring the role and responsibility of non-Indigenous people in confronting our colonial past as part of our own truth-telling. Engaging in this decolonization requires us to be willing to stay in the struggle of our own discomfort. So what if we were to take these, what I call unsettling stories, as powerful teaching moments from which we can learn to interact differently with Indigenous peoples with regard to our history? In 2004, I was honored to be part of an apology feast for Gitxsan residential school survivors that had attended the Edmonton Indian Residential School. So I just want to share briefly with you what the feast hall taught me. It taught me to rethink my cultural assumptions about the meaning of history, truth, justice, and reconciliation. I learned that history resides not in dusty books, but lives in the stories that we carry in our hearts, minds, and spirits as we struggle with the past that is still present. I learned that truth is not only about facts, but about the harsh realities of a shared colonial experience that is rooted in human relationships. I learned that justice is found not only in courtrooms, but in the exquisite beauty of sacred dances, symbols and songs, the strong words of elders, Simbiget and families, and in the healing ceremonies of the feast hall. I learned that reconciliation is not a goal to be achieved, but a place of transformative encounter where we gather courage to face our history honestly, despite the uncomfortable feelings of fear, guilt, and shame that public acts of restitution, apology, and remembering engender. The presenters at this conference remind me that I need to keep the teachings of the feast hall in my mind as I undertake my work at the TRC. To work with humility and to remember that my own deepest learning has always come from those times when I was in unfamiliar territory, culturally, intellectually, and emotionally. Paige Arthur said yesterday that truth creates doubt and uncertainty, and that this is a basis for dialogue. For non-Indigenous people, there is power in this place of not knowing that is key to our decolonization. Being in this place of not knowing and working through our own discomfort opens us to the kind of deep transformative learning that will be essential as we undertake the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paulette Reagan. We open the floor to questions now. There are two mics, one and two, if anybody has questions, please. Could you please say your name first?
Eliana Manrique. I work for the Red Cross in a program, Aboriginal Development, Respect Ed. And I just couldn't resist. I needed to thank you all for your wonderful presentations. I leave after these 2 days elated, empowered, hopeful, you know, because in these 2 days I was able to bridge this big gap between my experience of 4 years of living amongst the Inuit and sharing their lives, working for them, sharing their lives and their struggles, and into hope. And I was able to do it thanks to the magic of words. And the words that empowered me were the concept of the longer now, the concept of the living past, because I see how much I see that the greatest challenge that the commission is going to have to face is to go from what can appear to be the greatest danger is that it appears to be that the residential school was something that happened at a certain time and it ended, it finished. And so much of, and the challenge is to expose the roots, the ideological and cultural roots that made the residential schools possible. The more exposed they are, as Mr. Daniel, I think his name is Daniel Weinstock, explained yesterday, the more exposed and clear they are, the more we will be able to see how much of the residential schools is present in our schools today. And it is very important that we expose these roots, that we see them clearly, because we don't only owe this explanation to honor those who are the survivors of the residential schools, to honor those who lost their lives in more than one way to the residential schools, but we owe this explanation to our kids who are failing in the system, in a system that continues to carry all these information that made the residential schools possible and that is still living with us today. So thank you very much. Nakormik, Nakormik Marialok.
Nakomik, thank you very much. Yes?
My name is Melanie Burke. I'm from New York University. I was kind of anticipating, even before I came to the conference, some kind of discussion around the title of the conference, Breaking the Silence, and as it either was intentionally supposed to relate to the 1990s Assembly of First Nations book of this publication of the same title, and whether or not you know whether or not it was intentionally used for that purpose, I don't know if that's really the point, but whether or not, if it was or not, how does that, either way, address particularly what this panel was talking about in relation to conflicts with memory, testimony, and listening. Because if it was being reused, does that imply that it's foreseen that reusing of the title will somehow redress what should have or was intended to be addressed in a certain way with the title of the first publication, or in its coincidence, is it not also ironic and kind of proving the limitations that you were talking about?
Did you have a specific question to anyone on the panel, or?
Well, just anybody in general who wanted to, did my question make sense to anyone?
Yes.
Okay. Anybody who wanted to
address it? Any response from the panel or from the audience? No? Yes? All right, we'll go on to microphone 2.
Yes, thank you. Eric Large again, Saddlely Cree Nation, Alberta, Survivor Residential School, and also an RHSW. In my short 2.5-page presentation, I mentioned in there the hearing, there's a lot of hearing loss among us, either partial or full hearing loss. So that's one problem, one challenge the statement takers are going to be facing or have faced under the ADR. But there's an estimated 80,000 survivors. The problem with the ADR, it did some good work, but that's only a partial sample. There's, I don't know how many were interviewed in the ADR, but there's others too. I haven't been interviewed. I'd like some reassurance, and this is where we need to work together. Where how is the statement taken going to be done? Is it verbatim? You know, through notes or shorthand, cassette tapes, videotapes. It's the accuracy, I guess, I'd be concerned about. We should just let the survivors speak. A lot of them don't have the ability to express themselves. Again, that's a legacy of residential school. It's the accuracy. How would that be done? I mean, I'd like to get my story out, not to be distorted or... And then some of the older ones, they speak in their own language. Good luck to the statement takers. I guess that's my point. Thank you.
Would the commissioner be interested in answering this question? If the commissioner is in the room. Two of them right here. Would one of the commissioners be interested in answering the question, please? Or
I'll answer on behalf of the commissioners.
Thank you very much.
My name is Cyril. I work for the TRC. Can you hear me? Okay. My name is Cyril. I work for the TRC. I've been asked to answer on behalf of the commissioners. The statement taking, Eric, we take your concerns very seriously about making sure that the full story of survivors is captured and that we accept it fully and we understand fully not just the story of residential schools, but all of the things around it, your life story. So right now we're still in the design process for the statement taking, but we're looking at various methods depending on the needs of the survivor. So we're just exploring that right now. And in fact, I'd like to acknowledge Isabella Tartar from the Legacy of Hope, who's assisting us in that research. Thank you, Isabella. So thank you for your comment, Eric.
Thank you very much for answering that question.
Yes, I have a kind of partial, half-assed answer to the earlier question. about the AFN breaking the silence report from 1991. And I just remembered, I hadn't thought about it for a long time, but I think that the final conclusion of that report was that survivors had decided that they first needed to help themselves, then their families, and then their communities. And so I just thought that given the kind of bookending of the title of that report and this conference almost two decades later, that at least there's, maybe I'm making up for the doom and gloom my talk this morning, but there's obviously at least an intimation there that to have gotten from there to here, that there's been some progress on the purposes that the people speaking to the commissioners on the Breaking the Silence report, they've made some progress on what they were talking about.
Thank you very much. Let's go to mic number two, please.
Hi, thanks. My name is Val Napoleon. One of the things that your panel has caused me to think about is the form of the oral histories that many of our societies had, and how the purpose of those oral histories, say for the Gixan, there are three different types of oral histories. One is the owned oral histories that were covenants with the land and the major events of lineage systems and major lessons for survival of future generations. There are also unowned types of oral histories and so on. So like every society had ways of organizing information that was important for future generations. And I wondered if this might be a way that we can think about organizing this information as a major epic event that happened for future generations and the kinds of things that we might want future generations to think about. So it's looking at what are the form and content and how might it work with our own structures of narrative from our societies. And there's a woman, a scholar named Christine Black, who's Aboriginal from Australia, who's exploring some of that. And there's also a woman by the name of Jane Smith, who's a Gixan scholar, who's doing some of that work as well. And it might deal with some of the questions raised about memory and some of the different kinds of opposition, because what they engage listeners to do is to apply the information to contemporary circumstances and to engage the listener in metaphor and dealing with critical questions. I'd be interested if that was a direction that your work might go in.
Well, I'm gonna answer what you are asking. One of the things that I've been doing in my work in Indigenous child welfare is rewriting our story, Tultalos Lahaini, Wild Woman. And Tultalos Lahaini was a story that was told to us. Many cultures have a wild woman. And this story is usually about teaching our children how to be protected. And when the story originated, it was about being protected in the natural environment. And so we taught our children that when we would hear the owls hoot, that it was starting to get dark and you needed to start working your way home. We were taught to pay attention to the terrain around us and landmarks, and so that we could maneuver our way home and that we would always get home safe. We were taught to look for animal droppings to know whether they were fresh or old and might there be an animal in the vicinity that we needed to be cautious of. And so I turn this story around now and I say, you know, in the child welfare system, we've failed to give stories to our children to protect them. So we need to rewrite these stories now. And we need to look at ways that we can keep our children rooted in their culture and tradition and in their communities. And so now the perpetrators might be the child welfare system. And those might be the animals whose droppings we're looking for. And so, you know, trying to figure out how you tell that story in a modern way, and particularly in a way that we can tell our children. And so that's kind of one way that I've been doing it in the work that I do with child welfare. Thank you.
Any other comments? No? Let's go to mic number one then, please.
Thank you. My name is Iris Akus, and I come from the Sagamay First Nation in Saskatchewan. I'm a residential school survivor, generational, three generations at least in my family. And I also work as a resolution health support worker for the Yorkton Tribal Council. I want to acknowledge all of the people that are here, the presenters, those present, and those who have already left us. And want to say what a wonderful opportunity this was to be here, to listen to the presenters, people who have actually been involved in truth and reconciliation processes, and how much it has given me to think about. Being a survivor, working as a resolution health support worker, of course, my focus has been a lot on the survivors, our families, and our communities. And at the same time, keeping in mind all of the components of the residential school agreement, truth and reconciliation being one of them. And, you know, as much as possible, I try to keep up with where they're at in terms of the process. And this is one of the first events that I have, you know, that I am aware that they've had. I live in an area, Saskatchewan, and within a 500-mile radius, there are seven Indian residential schools. Saskatchewan, if I'm correct, has the highest number of Indian residential school survivors. We also have, you know, a large number of our children in care. The prisons, we have a high population of our people who are incarcerated. So we have a lot of work to do. What I want to say in relation to being part of this conference, international conference, as I said earlier, it has given me a lot to think about. And I think that's great that we have people who have that knowledge and expertise in terms of truth and reconciliation. I would like to invite the people who were here, perhaps to come into some of our communities, to get familiar with our communities, and perhaps share that knowledge and expertise again with us. And let's talk about how we can apply that in our for our truth and reconciliation process. One of the things that caused me, I can't say it's something new, is when our chief, national chief, Fontaine, talked about the agreement. And he talked about, you know, for each dollar that we, the Indian residential school survivors, were compensated, that it cost Canada $4 in administration. So the question, whether we look at the administration of the residential school financial compensation, is who is being compensated? In terms of, you know, compensation doesn't come about because of the, you know, the monies that people are receiving. Compensation is so much greater than that. It's the apology, it's the compensation. However, it's also about having an opportunity to tell our stories and for the work that needs to be done afterwards. And it's going to take a lot longer than 5 years to you know, undo some of the harms that have been done in our communities. And so in saying that, perhaps what we need to do is we need to be compensated, then we need to take some of the, you know, a portion of that $4 that's being paid and to administer the components of the residential school agreement. We need to take some of those monies and distribute those monies in our communities in order to be able to do the work that we need to do so that we can work towards healing ourselves and healing our families and healing our communities, and for our country, for Canada, you know, to also come to some truth about that, you know, the whole history of Canada and the Indian people, our people. So I would like to see, what I would like to see, and perhaps this is something for CETL and the commissioners, we have a First Nations University in Regina, Saskatoon, we have a campus. I think it would be great if we could also have one of these conferences in our community and have some of the people who are here, people like Eduardo and Pam, is it, and some of the other people who have that expertise, come to our communities and share that with our people. And I think that's all that I would like to say at this time. And I appreciate, you know, the many aspects of truth and reconciliation that we need to take into consideration when looking to do what is right by our people, our survivors, our people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir. If you.
Yes, my name is Michel Tousignan. I'm from University of Quebec in Montreal. I also work with suicide prevention among the Anishinaabe and Atikamekw communities of northern Quebec. So I just came this afternoon because I was in the field during the week, so I may be repeating some concerns, but I would like to, I'm very happy that the pedagogical aspect is really put to the fore. I think it's very important for these commissions that the whole population participate to this reconciliation. And from the point of view of Quebec, you know, I think that will put big challenge, because my concern, what I'm afraid of, is that you know, people will be very happy to hear these stories, because it'll be, oh, they'll say that it's the fault of the federal government, so people will project outside, and second, it's going to be the fault of the Catholic Church, second reason to be very happy. So, and they may not be able to see how, you know, they have participated in one form or another into this process of putting aside the Aboriginal communities. So I hope that, you know, the residential school will open to the whole topic of racisms of the general population, which is still going on in Quebec and the whole of Canada, so that people get really implicated and are not projecting the evil on the Canadian federal government and the Catholic Church. That's a big concern. The second concern is that people should see not only the hardship of the past, you know, what happened half a century ago, but also that the consequences are still going on. You know? We have, in the community where I worked, up to 20% of the children are placed that are taking from their parents. So it's almost a repetition of what happened half a century ago with the residential schools. And this is a very actual problem. I think that people have to see also the transgenerational consequences to be really sensitized to this problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I know Roger Simon would like to make a comment.
Thanks for those comments, because they're extremely important. The notion that people don't come to the stories as empty vessels, I think, is illustrated, in fact, exactly with the example that you provided. I think it's also quite interesting to think about how in Quebec, particularly, the notion that we live in a long now is very much a part of the entire culture. The sense that the conquest is not over, that we live with the notion of the conquest, is part of the historical consciousness of many Quebecois. So that we have to think more complexly about the issue of simply telling the story, assuming that in simply telling the story, everybody will understand it in the same way and have the same response. And the question about why we have to think pedagogically about particular audiences and what particular interventions might open up a different way of attending to the stories is precisely made by the example that that you've given. And I think there are good and interesting ways to turn the question of what those stories mean to you here in Quebec in different terms other than the notion that it was the fault of the government, it was the fault of the church. There are ways of beginning to ask the questions, such as, why have I not heard these stories before? What kind of educational mm-hmm. system do I have in this particular province? Why are those stories missing from my school system, my society? It's a different kind of way of attending to the story.
Thank you very much. We'll go over to mic number one, please.
Thank you. Tansagakio, Nagoachik, Sweetgrass, Saskatchewan, Ochenia, Donna Pascoman, Sihaswan. My question is, I work with the Saskatchewan Indian Cultural Center in Saskatoon. We're part of the National Board of Cultural Centers. There's 87 cultural centers. For an example, we have 74 First Nations that we represent, 8 different languages in Saskatchewan alone. Onakawik, the 3 different Cree variations, the TH and then the Y, the Dakota, Nakota, Lakota, and the Dene. And my question is that we are mandated to preserve, protect, and promote our First Nations languages. And this will be a question both particularly to the commissioners here and to the panel, is how does the commission see the role and use of the language and culture in relationship to this truth and reconciliation process? Prior to, during, and follow-up to the commission. I just hope that it's just not being used as a technical tool. Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Dumont-Smith or Ms. Morley, would you care to comment on the question? Thank you very much.
I guess what I could say at this point is that we know that there are 52 different First Nations in Canada. We know of the Métis, we know of the Inuit that have all their specific cultures, and there are all these different linguistic groups. We will be guided by a survivor committee of people from across Canada, and we will also be guided in our work by regional liaison workers, and we're hoping and we will demand of them that they inform us as to the cultural protocols and practices of everywhere that the TRC Commission will be traveling. And also, we will see to it that if people, elders especially, who come to the TRC and who are only able to speak in their traditional language, that we will have some people who can converse with them in their language and then provide that information to us. So we will be working in that way with the people out in the community as well. We will make some links with the cultural group that the speaker before me just spoke about. And we know that that's a very important component, because if we don't look at the culture and the language of the TRC, which is the Indian Residential School TRC Commission, then we're a commission like every other, and we're different, and we're going to do things in a different way. Thank you.
Thank you very much for answering. Mic number two, please.
My Christian name is Irene Otter. First, I'd like to thank my Creator for being here. It's been a great experience. I didn't think I would be here today. And it's good to see some people that I know that have helped my community on this journey. It's been a long time since Waswanapee, my community, has been working on this residential school. When we started was about 15 years ago. We had different conferences in my community just to get people to open up. We had to go back to the residential school. It was quite an experience for some of my people. I was sitting on the committee to bring the people back to the school. When we came home, we had a welcoming home ceremony, which we never had when we came home from school. Most of our people were out on the land. And it was quite an experience for them, very moving. It's been a long process for us. We've had to look for funding. We had to write. We've been sent books this big just to fill out a form to ask for funding. I've just spoken to someone here telling him I'm going to ask him for more money, although it was only for 5 years. We were supposed to get money. We're also looking into our own council and other entities in my community to help out, because the way my elders tell me, it doesn't take just 5 years. It's finished, it's gone. It's gonna take a lifetime, even longer, the next generation. Because what's happening in my community, there's still some people that didn't open up. So what do we do with them? There are people, we don't know where they are. What do we do? There are people that have passed on. Their stories will never be told. I have some stories of those who have passed on. We've even had a ceremony for them at home. In all things, we look at all the people that we, when we do something, whether you're Catholic, Anglican, traditional, Pentecostal, you name it, because this is what they made of us in my community. Some of us speak English, some speak French, and mostly Cree. I speak three languages. I'm glad I speak three languages. I can understand what's going on. I'm proud of who I have become. I didn't lose very much. I always had my great-grandmother when I was home. She helped me. My elders are my teachers. The thing they teach me they taught me when I was young, I will say it in Cree, Egoi Maitiga. That has many meanings. I'll just say one couple of things. Do not hurt or harm anything or anyone. I've held on to that for many years. I had to leave home to learn how to help my people, because there was too much going on in my community from the effects of going to residential school. I've also had people come up to me and tell me, why don't you tell them, get over it. I said, it took a long time for us to even start our healing journey. And I said, when I will come here, I've said a prayer ever since I came into town. I know Montreal pretty well. I've been to Kahnawake, I've been to Oka, And I all know there's people that live there. I hope that the TRC as my people tell me, is a good thing, as long as there's respect, as long as they honor the people they are working for. The other problem we have in my community now is they're taking our children away. That's something else we have to fight for. We've already also spoken to Cree Health Board Social Services. We do not want the children taken away. We know what it felt like. We also have a few people that were taken away when they were young from their parents who went to residential school. They don't speak Cree. They don't know our culture. I work with the culture department. I sit on many committees. I like what I'm doing, and I was honored to be here. I thank you all for all the information I'm going to bring home, and hopefully you all will do your work from the heart. Igrech.
Thank you very, very much. Please.
Good afternoon. My name is Delbert Sampson from the Shuswap Nation of Simon Island, British Columbia. And I work for Federal Corrections Canada. I'm thankful to be here. Thank you for the invite to come and help you out with a prayer. It was a great honor. I thank you all you people that have been here, I thank you for your commitments and all your hard work you've done over the many years to come and share this information with us. We've been taught to say thank you for everything that we receive, especially in my life. Just want to say, excuse me. It says something that teaches truth and honesty in my work. And I work with inmates, and I tell them to be honest. If you're feeling hurt, I say be honest. Because if you put it aside and say, no, we can't do this right now, there's results to that. Myself, I always ask the Creator, what is this that I need to share? And I had a lot of preconceived thoughts of what I wanted to say. And I said, wow, it never ends up like that, you know? And this is what I teach the guys, you know? You have to go with whatever comes your way. And take care of it and follow through and be responsible. This is what being responsible is all about. It's taking care of yourself. When you take care of yourself, you can take care of others. Forgive yourself, you can forgive others. And this is the way that life works. And so and something that I've come to understand since I've been here and hearing all this information is that I need to continue to reach out for more help because I see a lot of problems. I see a lot of issues within the community, native and non-native, and I see solutions. And this is what I teach people, to ask for help. Don't be shy to ask for help. Go around. There's a lot of volunteer communities all around Montreal. And if you go participate and you say, hey, I'd like to see this happening, there's people who are more than willing to come and help out. And this is what all are shared. And I'm very thankful because I'm a survivor of residential school, and my parents have been there too. And I'm very thankful for that, because it's taught me a lot today of who I am. I found many ways to empower myself. I've traveled around the country, out of California, I've done sweat lodges over there, Arizona, down in Texas, New Mexico, Alberta, Saskatchewan, out east, and I've done a lot of ceremonies with many different nations. And I find that out of all of our ceremonies, what it teaches is empowerment. It gives you the things that you need. It gives you knowledge. It takes care of all the ignorance, all the fear, all the shame, all the guilt. At a very young age, I learned to be a really good drama queen and very reactionary. I learned that at a young age, and I did that for a very long time. It caused my alcohol and drugs till I was 42 years old, when I finally realized I don't need to be like that anymore. There's a better life. But I had to go through all that to understand that, and I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful for that residential school, for all my experiences there. The 7 years I was there, it taught me a lot about human beings and how we all are and how things need to be. And I'm very thankful for that. I went to Edmonton and I participated in the Nietzsche Alcohol and Drug Training Program to teach you to be a drug and alcohol counselor, and I'm very thankful for that, because I still use a lot of that today in my work. And they have the Western way of society, the university programs that they teach, but also the traditional way with the sweat lodges and the circles and the medicines. This is what we need in our education society today. And I would really recommend that this start happening. It is starting to happen in some schools. But to myself, I think it needs to be done by Native people. Because my daughter was telling me she was in a school, there's a non-Native teacher telling her about the four directions and the four colors, and you had it kind of all backwards, and so you had to correct them, you know. But I'm glad at least it's being tried, you know. These things are starting to happen. So I just wanted to thank you all for being here, and some of this information that's being shared, and I know it's going to go a long ways. And I just, us, we always teach with encouragement to encourage other people. So I say, Kukshan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. Yes, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Rosa Washi. I'm from the Northwest Territories, and I'm representing the Department of Health and Social Services. And I have something to share, in that in the Northwest Territories, some of our communities take out the new teachers along with people in the community to bring them some knowledge about the way that people used to live years and years ago. So they take them out on the land and teach them how to live out on the land before they start teaching the students within the community. So I was wondering if the commission was even considering going out on the land with various Aboriginal groups throughout the provinces and the territories so that they can get some concept of the way that we used to live as peoples. And also go through a cleansing exercise before they take on their role. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that we have concerns in the North about funding. How is the Commission proposing to travel throughout the Northwest Territories when we are geographically isolated? And when might we learn of their schedule to travel? I'm really nervous. But in any regard, those are the questions that we do have in the Northwest Territories. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm wondering if one of the two commissioners might address the questions, please. Ms. Morley?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for those questions. I don't have a complete answer, and probably I certainly don't have a schedule to give you. But what I can say is that we recognize that the North, that there's an enormous issue in terms of distance and traveling. But I think the fundamental answer is part of our mandate is to have community events. And that's over the whole 5 years of our mandate. And the purpose of those community events is to respond to the particular communities and their needs. And the expectation that we have is that that the design of those events will come from those communities. And they will, and so your suggestions of what we might do that would reflect the culture and the practices, the traditional practices that you have, the answer is if that's what the community wants us to do, then we're open to doing that. And so we need the communities to, and we understand that communities don't have the resources to do it themselves. So we will be supporting communities in whatever events that they may have, but those events will be designed by the communities, and we will be participating. We'll be supporting them in the design of it, and we will be ready to participate, and we recognize that means travel. We've already, all three of us, have traveled up north. I was relatively recently in the Northwest Territories with a group of survivors. The Dene Nation was putting that on. And I went there to speak, and to really talk about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We're still in our formative period, so that wasn't a quote community event under our schedule that tells us how we're to do things. But it was an important thing that I did, and Commissioner Dumont Smith was also up north, as was Chair Harry Laforme. And we've heard loud and clear that the North doesn't want to be forgotten in our process. So we recognize that. And we recognize that there's a price tag that comes along with that because of the travel. So I hope that answers your question to some extent.
Ms. Morley, before you sit down, may I have the privilege of asking you a question, invoking chair's privilege here. I don't know if I have one, in fact. I gather the commission has been somewhat criticized occasionally by not having an Inuit member. Is that something that is being addressed or maybe has already been addressed?
Well, in terms of you mean a member of the commission itself? Yes.
Commission that is not First Nations but Inuit.
Right. The number of commissioners was set out in the settlement agreement, and the Inuit were a party to that agreement. And there were to be three commissioners. The agreement also set out a selection committee, a selection process, which had a selection committee that was made up of representatives from all the different parties, including the Inuit and others. And they were to come up with a number of names, which they did. And those names were presented to government, and the government made the appointment in consultation with the Assembly of First Nations. At least that's what it says in the schedule that they're supposed to do, in the mandate that they're supposed to do. So in terms of the commission itself, we've been formulated. We became the commission. We have no jurisdiction or authority to increase our numbers. However, we do recognize that it's important to have have that perspective, and we certainly have talked about and feel it's important that in terms of our staff and our secretariat that we include people that have that perspective. And it's partly because out of recognition of that issue that has been raised, and we're certainly aware of it, that we've made a point, each one of us, of going north in a period of time when we were more focusing on getting together to figure out what our mandate was and how to move forward. But we felt it was crucial that we go north and we hear that perspective, and we will continue to do that. The other thing my colleague is reminding me of is that we do also have, as part of the settlement agreement, a survivor committee, and there will be someone from the North the representing the Inuit on that survivor committee.
Thank you very, very much. Sorry.
No problem. My name is Raymond Martineau. I'm associate professor at the University of Sherbrooke. Several of the speakers said that the reconciliation process, the healing process, should be a global process for the healing of the whole country. And I'm convinced on that, and I'm convinced that there cannot be any healing, any reconciliation, any truth, if the non-Indigenous people are not integrated into this process. And I feel that the way I've heard presentation of the commission, and it's normal because this is the indigenous people who have asked for this commission, that it's geared towards indigenous people because they are the ones who need it or who are conscious that they need it. But I think non-indigenous people in Canada need that process very urgently. And many people mentioned the need for public education, the need for rewriting the history of our country. And I remember Desmond Tutu in South Africa used to say, white people will not go to heaven without us. We'll go to heaven together. And that's true. And I think there will be a healing process, a reconciliation process, if we are all part of it. And I would like to ask the commissioner how they see that we could all work together. And I'm thinking of university, because I'm at university, and what my colleague said earlier here from the Université du Québec à Montréal, I completely agree with him. I think that we have to work more with young people and maybe take this momentum of this commission to try to do some effort in more education, more information of young people, and trying to make more people conscious that this healing process is necessary, not only for indigenous people, but for all of us. I've been 35 years away from the country, and I've learned more about indigenous people from Canada and Quebec in Geneva, Switzerland, when I was working in the United Nations, than I've ever learned here in Canada. But I thought that the young generation, they must have heard more than we have heard before. And when I came back and I started to work at the university, I was surprised that they don't know more than we did. When I was at school or at college, that there's been no progress in teaching history to young people. So I think we should join efforts together to use this momentum of the commission to do this type of public awareness and education. Thank you.
Thank you very much.